This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're postponing our interview with Barry Sonnenfeld, director of Men in Black 2, until tomorrow so that we can remember the film director John Frankenheimer. He died Saturday at the age of 72 of a stroke resulting from complications after spinal surgery. John Frankenheimer started his career in the 50s directing live TV dramas for the series Playhouse 90. One of his additions was the acclaimed drama The Days of Wine and Roses. He started making movies in the late 50s. His best-known films include The Birdman of Alcatraz, All Fall Down, The Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, I Walk the Line, and French Connection 2. His career was erratic in the 70s and 80s. He attributed that to alcohol. His comeback in the 90s included several Emmy Award-winning HBO and TNT films. His latest HBO film, Path to War, was shown earlier this year. His most recent theatrical releases were Ronin and Reindeer Games. I spoke with Frankenheimer in 1990 after the release of his political thriller, The Fourth War.
You've done several films about the military, 7 Days in May, The Manchurian Candidate. You went to military school as a child, right?
Yes, it's true.
Did you feel like that gave you insights into the military mind at all?
Yes, I do. And I also was a lieutenant in the Air Force, and I was General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War and things like that. And yes, I do. I feel that it's given me a tremendous insight into the military mind, especially on higher levels, because I was around general officers a lot. And it's helped me.
When you were General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War, what did that entail?
Well, it entailed photographing the general quite a bit. It entailed, it entailed also doing some training films. I was in the Air Photographic Squadron that did a lot of training films in the United States. That's how I started, actually.
Started making movies.
Yeah.
Did you prefer making documentary films for the military to fighting?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm not a fool. I mean, I'm not crazy. Yeah, I loved it.
I want to ask you a little bit about The Manchurian Candidate, which I think is just a really extraordinary movie. You were the co-producer of the movie. I assume that means that you were one of the people who were behind making it, as opposed to a director who was brought on after the idea.
Yes, was already in effect. In this particular case, George Axelrod and I bought the book. We developed it, and then I ended up directing it, of course.
How did Sinatra get involved with the movie?
Well, Sinatra was the whole element that made the movie possible. The movie had been turned down by every studio in town. And when George Axelrod and I bought the book, we bought it by buying the book in a bookstore. It had been optioned and reoptioned and dropped and never been able to be made. And we knew that Frank Sinatra had read the book and Frank Sinatra was interested in the picture, but he had never really gone the whole nine yards and optioned it. So we optioned it, and without a script, Frank Sinatra committed to it. And, of course, as soon as he committed to it, we had the necessary financing to make the movie.
Did you have any idea he'd be as good as he was in it? I mean, did you have as much faith in his acting abilities when you started?
No. I didn't want to make the movie with Frank Sinatra. I was scared of it. I had heard he was very difficult. I had heard that he treated directors badly, all those things. I expressed these reservations to George Axelrod, and he said, I'm going to make the movie with Frank Sinatra, whether you do it or whether you don't. He said, I'll buy you out, but I want to make this movie with Sinatra. Sinatra's going to get this picture made. And if you have problems with Sinatra, he said, I would suggest that you discuss them with him instead of discussing them with me. And I made an appointment to see Mr. Sinatra. I went up to see him at his house, and I expressed my reservations to him. And he said, look, I guarantee you, whether what you've heard is true, whether what you've heard is not true, there is my side to all that, too. He said, I want to do this picture, I want to work with you, and I feel that we're going to get along just fine. And that was the last discussion we ever had. We got along absolutely fabulously. I loved working with Frank Sinatra. It was a joy making that picture. It was one of the happiest experiences in my life making that picture, and I loved everything that Sinatra did. I mean, he was just a joy to work with, and we've been close friends ever since.
There's a scene I have to ask you about. It's really an extraordinary scene. This is the garden club dream scene. Frank Sinatra is having these recurring nightmares in which he's with all of the men from his army troop from the Korean War. He's with them at a ladies' garden club, and suddenly the ladies' garden club turns into a lot of Korean soldiers, and the head Korean soldier is discussing how he's brainwashing these soldiers into believing that they're at a garden party. And then to show how brainwashed they really are, he has Lawrence Harvey just walk over and strangle to death one of the men. You shot that scene in such a disorienting way. The camera just kind of revolves around all the women of the garden club first, and then suddenly the women are transformed into men, and you're as confused as Frank Sinatra is by all of this. Tell me about how you decided to shoot this scene.
Well, number one, the idea of the scene came right out of Richard Condon's book. He described pretty well what the scene should look like. So it was up to me to interpret it. And the shot that you're talking about is a 360-degree shot, which starts on the stage of a hotel in New Jersey where a woman is talking about hydrangeas, and we pan around the room, and you think that it's just women listening to this, a garden club. And then as the camera completes its 360-degree arc, you suddenly find yourself on a stage in an amphitheater in Korea, and the Chinese psychiatrist is talking about brainwashing. So what we did was we designed a set that could be moved, and it took a little athletic ability from the actors to run from one platform to the other while we were back on the garden club. And the two platforms were on a kind of a railroad track, and we slid one right in place as the camera moved off the first one. But what it did was it set in the audience's mind that this was not just the magic in the movies, that something very strange here was happening, because we never cut. And the audience realizes when you cut. They might not know what it is, but they know that there's been some mechanical device put between them and the story. And I wanted to do it all in one shot. And I think after we accomplished that shot, then we were able to cut to anything that we wanted to do. And we filmed that sequence with about 7 or 8 different combinations. The women in Korea, the Chinese Manchurian delegates in New Jersey, the actors on the New Jersey hotel, the actors in the Korean amphitheater. And we were able to intercut it at will, back and forth. And after the first shot, the suspension of disbelief with the audience was complete. So we were able to kind of manipulate them back and forth whenever we wanted to. And you're right, we did cut it in such a way that it was confusing, and deliberately so.
Now, one of the black men from this same troupe that Sinatra was in has the same dream. But when he has the dream, all of the women from the ladies' club are black. Was that in the novel, or is that your invention, to have the two people have their own version of this same dream?
That was me. What I never did do, I mean, I had it done, but I just didn't dare take the shot of it. In the back of the room, we had a white bellboy. But we never did show it. If you look carefully, you can see it.
That's great. It's a wonderful... It's wonderful the way you contrast the two dreams.
You know, I want to tell you one other thing about that movie. That's something that I don't think people are aware of, but I think it's important to say in these days and times, which is that was one of the first movies where the producer and director used a black actor to play a part that was not written for a black.
Uh-huh.
Today it's done quite often, but that was very new at the time, to take the black actor, cast him as the psychiatrist. And that part was not written for a black actor. I've since done it quite a bit, but I just wanted to bring that up.
John Frankenheimer is my guest. The movie was released in 1962. This was just before the Kennedy assassination. Manchurian Candidate was out of circulation for 26 years. It was re-released in 1987. I know Frank Sinatra was a friend of Kennedy. Is that why the movie was out of circulation for so long?
No,
It had nothing to do with the assassination?
No.
What is the story?
The story is basically one of greed, of money, as most American stories are. The movie was out of circulation for the simple reason that United Artists carried the movie through a complicated process of Chinese bookkeeping, totally in the red for years and years and years. They had it cross-collateralized with every other movie that Frank Sinatra had made for United Artists. And we were so far in the red that if we had been E.T. and re-released, we would have been in the red. And when this movie finished its run, which was before the president's assassination, there were no ancillary markets as you know them today. There was no tape. There was no cable. There just wasn't anything like that. And what there was network television and then syndicated television. Then you went into the archives, which all these movies did. And in fact, The Manchurian Candidate did play on network television one time around. However, what they failed to realize was that in 1970, the rights reverted to Frank Sinatra, the rights for re-release. They had just thrown this in as a bone in his contract to get him to agree to other things. And it was the best thing in the world for us, because what happened was that a market was developed for the movie. I mean, the press loved the movie. The media loved the movie. And the more people talked about the movie, the less it became possible to see it. And what happened was, finally, there was a management in place at United Artists for 25 minutes or long enough for us to negotiate a deal with them so that we could start out from scratch, and we were neither in the red nor in the black, to re-release the movie, and that's what we did. And it turned out very nicely for all of us.
We're listening back to a 1990 interview with film director John Frankenheimer. He died Saturday at the age of 72. We'll hear more of that interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director John Frankenheimer.
You were good friends with Bobby Kennedy, and I believe you were with him the night that he was assassinated.
Yes, I was.
And he was supposed to go to your house afterwards. I think you were working with him on campaign ads.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, he was staying at my house, actually, and I drove him to the Ambassador Hotel, and I had done his film and television during his campaign, yes.
What effect did it have on you when he was assassinated?
Terrible. Really, honest to God, Terry, terrible. I had, in layman's terms, a nervous breakdown. I moved to Europe. I stayed in Europe for 7 years after that. It just was really, it was a terrible traumatic effect on me.
Was it because... I mean, I guess I understand why, but was it because you were that close, or because of the suddenness and because of the assassination?
All of it.
Yeah.
I was close to him. I honestly believed, and I had let myself be totally convinced, that this man would have been a superb president of the United States, and I honestly believe that to this day. And to see that all shattered in that one horrible moment was just more than I could accept. I mean, I had a very bad time after it.
So you left the States for a while?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I know it was because of that. I let it be. I kind of made believe it was for other reasons, but that was basically what the reason was.
And how did that affect your movie career? I mean, you weren't here making movies for several years.
No, but I made movies in Europe, and I made some good ones.
Which ones did you make in Europe?
Well, I made The Fixer. I made a movie called The Horseman. I made Impossible Object, French Connection 2. And I had a pretty active career over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you about French Connection 2. The way I understand it, Gene Hackman called you, said they want to do a sequel to French Connection 1. Why did he call you?
Well, number one, he didn't.
Okay. Tell me the real story.
The real story is that... I had a story, and Fox had a title. 20th Century Fox had a commitment with Gene Hackman, and they had a title, French Connection 2.
Uh-huh.
They had no story. I had a very, very interesting story, which was a narcotics cop being turned into a drug addict. And I thought, and I couldn't get it made, and I thought, wait a minute, this could work for French Connection 2. And I went to 20th Century Fox, and we sold them the idea of this story. And they loved it. And then we sold it to Gene Hackman, with whom I had worked on the Gypsy Moths some years before.
Yeah, well, what happens is, you know, Hackman goes to Marseille to track down the head of this drug ring, and they end up shooting him up with heroin and getting him addicted, and then he has to go through cold turkey. Tell me about the dramatic possibilities you saw in the story that you created here of having the narcotics agent become an addict himself.
Well, I thought it was... I love irony, and I thought that was the ultimate irony, especially to have Popeye Doyle become a drug addict, a cop that was so against this and was so adamant that he would never do this kind of thing, and to have this happen to him. And then, of course, Hackman is such a wonderful actor, and the idea of having Hackman go through this whole cold turkey withdrawal was something that I thought the possibilities were endless, and I think he was brilliant in those scenes, incidentally.
Well, some of your early work was in live television doing dramas. You did a lot of Playhouse 90s.
I did, yes. I did 153 live television shows.
Yeah, that's really a lot. Was there a lot of improvising required on your part as a director? If something would go wrong, you'd have to just kind of follow through on it.
Strangely, in the 153 shows that I did, very few things ever went wrong. We went into the shows very, very well prepared. Don't forget, we rehearsed in most of those shows for over 3 weeks. We had 4 days on camera. We had a highly, highly trained and expert camera crew. Every shot was predetermined. Every shot was thought out. Every shot had been marked in my script long before we ever got on camera. The most horrendous things that ever happened to me in live television was when I was an assistant director and not in control of my own destiny. I remember when I was an assistant director and Eva Marie Saint and Frances L. Sullivan were on this show, and they were supposed to be flying 50,000 feet above the Himalayas and be crash land and be rescued by these Chinese ski troops. We were in this set, which was about the size of a postage stamp with the two actors, and suddenly Frances L. Sullivan, who was making his live television debut, just went up. I mean, he just couldn't remember his lines. It was supposed to be 50,000 feet above the Himalayas, and he just looked into the camera. He said, my stop. He says, I think I'll get off. And he just got and he walked off the set. And we cut to the camera one, which was on the commercial announcer, and there was no sound on the commercial announcer. And you saw him talking to the agency man, and over this you heard this English accent saying, 40 years in this bloody business, and oh, I've never got up. And suddenly the sound came on over the commercial announcer, and he starts doing the Armstrong Cork commercial. I mean, it was just an unbelievable mess, at which point I was on the phone to Master Control in New York. And we were doing it from New York, and I said, look, you've got to take us off the air. There's nothing we can do now. It's just gone. Do anything. Just run a movie, anything. And they did take us off the air. That's the only time that that's ever happened.
Film director John Frankenheimer, recorded in 1990. He died Saturday at the age of 72. The poet Kenneth Koch also died on Saturday of leukemia. He was 77. Koch was a scholar and a fan of the great tradition of classical European poetry. Writer Ron Padgett said Koch's gift was to combine modernism and lyricism and write poems that gave you a feeling as joyous as Whitman. In the 1950s, Kenneth Koch's circle of friends included fellow poets John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara, and painters Larry Rivers and Jane Froelicher. They collaborated on artistic projects and became known for their defiantly anti-academic stance. Some critics dubbed them the New York School of Poets. In 1987, I asked Koch to read an excerpt from his poem Fate about his relationship with Ashbery, O'Hara, Rivers, and Froelicher.
I went to Europe for the first time when I was in my early 20s, and my friends, my best friends, Frank and John and Jane and Larry, they hadn't been to Europe yet, and I was all excited about my time in France, and I came back with some whiskey I'd gotten in Shannon, Ireland, where the planes used to stop, and tried to tell them how wonderful Europe was, and they wouldn't pay any attention to me because they hadn't been there and they were interested in other things. Later on, it always seemed to me this was sort of a wonderful moment in my life, though I didn't know why. I called it fate. In a room on West 10th Street in June of 1951, Frank O'Hara and I and Larry Rivers, I actually do not remember if Larry was there, but he would be there later some winter night on the stairway, sitting, waiting, a demented telephone, as Frank said in an article about him. But then on the stairs, unhappy in a youthful manner, much happened later. Frank, John Ashbery, Jane Froelicher, and I had just come back from Europe for the first time. I had a bottle of Irish whiskey I'd bought in Shannon where the plane stopped, and we drank it. And I told my friends about Europe. They'd never been there, how much I'd loved it. I was so happy to be there with them. And my Europe, too, which I had, Greece, Italy, France, Scandinavia, and England. Imagine having all that the first time. The walls were white in that little apartment, so tiny. The rooms are so small, but we all fitted into one and talked. Frank, so sure of his talent, but didn't say it that way. I didn't know it till after he was dead, just how sure he had been. And John, unhappy and brilliant and silly. And of them all, my first friend. We had met at Harvard. They tended, except Frank, to poo-poo what I said about Europe. And even Frank was more interested, but ever polite, when sober. I couldn't tell it, but barely tended. They tended to be much more interested in gossip, such as who had been sleeping with whom and what was selling and going on, whereat I was a little hurt, but used to it. My expectations from my friendships were absurd, but that way I got so much out of them. In fact, it wasn't causal, but the two ways at once. I was never so happy with anyone as I was with those friends, at that particular time, on that day, with that bottle of Irish whiskey, the time 4 in the afternoon or 3 in the afternoon or 2 or 5, I don't know what. And why do I think that my being so happy is so urgent and important? It seems some kind of evidence of the truth, as if I could go back and take it, or do I just want to hold what there is of it now?
Poet Kenneth Koch, recorded in 1987. He died Saturday at the age of 77. We'll feature our postponed interview with Barry Sonnenfeld, director of Men in Black and Men in Black 2, tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.